Last week we spent some time discussing whether or not the Din of Beis Din Nota applies only to a Beis Din that makes decisions, like a typical Beis Din that adjudicates cases, Din Mamonos, Din Nefashos, even Beis Din Hagadol, that requires, according to those who require it, an odd number in order to have the capacity, or to emphasize the capacity for self-sufficiency, and therefore the ability of, or decisiveness, or both. However, the question that we discussed was, what if you have a Beis Din which focuses on Maisa Beis Din, Beis Din as a declaration, a proclamation, a representation of some sort, for example, in Par Halim Davishol Tzibor, or Egla Rufa, or Chalitza, or Geirus, or Kiddush HaChodesh. We even discussed the problem of Prizbul and Bitul Haget. In all these cases, Beis Din is a presence, or as I say, they're a legal or formal body that designates proclaims some formal status. But they're not, and of course there are along the ways perhaps some issues that arise where they take stands and where there may even be disputes and the requirement of decision making. But that's a far cry from saying that they're a Beis Din of decision making. In other words, when two, Balei Dinim appear before a court, or somebody's on trial for, a capital offense, then it's fundamentally the task of the Beis Din to make decisions. It's a decision-making Beis Din. But if you have a Beis Din whose, focus is a Maisa Beis Din, as we just discussed, the fact that, agav urcha, along the way, there may be, some controversies and some issues to rule on, etc., does not a decision-making Beis Din make. And therefore, we're talking about two different kinds or categories of Beis Din. So what we saw was that there's a huge machlokas harishonim regarding these issues. Number one, where you draw the line in what constitutes a decision-making Beis Din, how much of the peripheral decision-making is sufficient to qualify it for that. But even more importantly, this bigger question, whether or not the requirement of Beis Din Nota of an odd number Beis Din, maybe one which connotes the self-sufficiency or the unit aspect of Beis Din, to what extent does all of that really apply across the board in Bate Dinim? Every Beis Din has to have the ability to be that kind of a Beis Din, to make decisions and to have that status? No, not at all. It's we have a sharp line of demarcation between different types of Bate Dinim. So that's what we were discussing last time with regard to numerous of these cases. Now I want to go back and elaborate a little bit more on what we were developing before that and connected with it, and that is the idea of whether Beis Din is a unit, a group, the consensus of which comes to a certain conclusion, or whether or not Beis Din is composed of, practically this is certainly the case, but legally, do we look at Beis Din as being composed of individual dayanim, right, the majority of whom decide a case, in which case the case is decided by the majority, not by the minority, and the number of dayanim are established at the outset with an eye towards, achieving a certain minimum decision-making dayanim in that part of the process. But really, the minority judge is, again, he's going to draw his paycheck, as we discussed, and he still gets to keep his title and all of the, appurtenances, that are connected to it. But in a sense, when he's been outvoted, this decision is not his decision, and the decision is in the hands of those, and only of those, who've made it. So this was very relevant to our discussion of how there can be a majority rule in Beis Din when we have a rule of Ein Hochin B'Mamon Achar Rov and the discussion of Tosfos and Bava Kamma and Reb Chaim and the various ways to look at it. I just want to mention very quickly without going into detail because each of these could be a topic in its own right, a couple of other echoes of this, and then I want to discuss the sugya that we alluded to on Chav Tes and Daf Lamed, and then on Daf Hayom and Beis. There's an interesting discussion in the Rishonim, then later in the Achronim, why it is that we go by Rov when it comes to Dayanim, as we established in our Gemara here, Gimel and Beis. After all, in addition to the question of Motzi Mechuyel Avaraya, which we already discussed, there's another problem, and that is we have a rule in the world of Sveikos. It's called Kol Kavua Kemachtza Amachtza Dami. Meaning whenever a doubt exists in a stable, you know, environment, we could call it, or in a static environment, maybe a better way to say it, we treat it as a 50-50 suffix, even though it doesn't reflect the real probabilities. So, for example, if a person has a suffix, you know, whether or not the object that he, has in his pocket, you know, was bought in, one of the nine, kosher butcher shops, or the 10th Trefa butcher shop, which he frequented, since if we find an object in the street and we focus on it only, benimtza, where it is, so then we apply the principle of azinu basaro. But when the suffix is nolad bekavua, meaning when the factors are static, I mean they're not moving around, then the rule is kol kavua kemachtza machtza dami. Now whether this is daraisa, drabanan, what it's based on, it's a very difficult concept, as I say, but this, something we encountered, in parallels, it's not based on probability at all. In other words, the likelihood that if there are nine butcher shops, nine kosher butcher shops and one trefa butcher shop, or vice versa, so, if there's no, objective reason to think that, the meat in question came from one or more than the other, so then the probabilities of, of its origin are very strong. They're 90%. But this is the rule. Kol kavua kemachtza amachtza. And we apply this rule, seemingly even in Doraisa situations. Gemara in Ksuvos Daf Tes Vav has this concept, and elsewhere as well. Why am I telling you this? So the Mordechai in Masachet Chulin, and the Rokeach as well, and Sefer Rokeach, ask why isn't the debate between judges, the judges are sitting in one place, they're not wandering around, so it's a safek bekavua. Judge number one says this, judge number two says that, judge number three says a third thing, they're all sitting in judgment. So since they're all sitting in the room there, it's not, you haven't isolated the safek in any way, and it's not a mobile, on the move safek, it's called safek bekavua. It's like the butcher shops, which are, each is in a venue, right? This is located in this spot, and this one is located in that spot, and the other one is located in a third spot. So too, the dayanim are not, mobile, and they're, sitting in court, and the question is, why don't we treat this as kavua? Why do we say as linu basarab? It's kind of a question that's a little bit quirky, because we know that there's something wrong with the question. But, it's challenging to figure out what's wrong with the question. And I'm not going to go into the details, but there are a lot of answers that are given to the question. The one of the answers in the Rokeach, and possibly this is one of the intended answers of the Mordechai as well, is based on the principle, that we have been adducing. Namely, if it's really true that the way that we look at a debate between the judges and the decision that issues from that is not in terms of, strictly speaking, majority rules, in other words, individual dayanim, two against one, but rather, put it this way, if we look at it that way, so then we are legitimately confronted with this question. It still sounds quirky. There still seems to be something wrong with it. Some of the Rishonim say, well, the words you know, are moving around. You know, the judges are in their place, which is another way of saying that the suffix isn't in the, you know, physical persona of the judges. It's in the, you know, clash or the debate, you know, surrounding ideas, you know, that we're, you know, that we're exposed to here. So the, you know, the words, that's their way of saying, but they don't really mean the words, disembodied words. They mean, you know, the deos are really not kavua, you know, in a typical sense. Not like, you know, butcher shops, you know, which are very substantial, you know, entrepreneurial enterprises and you know, entities. And, you know, as long as it may have come from there, you can't deny, you know, those presences. Here, you know, we're talking about a fluid, dynamic, you know, exchange of ideas. So there are many good answers, you know, to this question. But the point is that you have to figure out, you have to formulate a good answer in terms of, you know, both Dayanim and especially Kavua. But that's only if the question gets off the ground. The question gets off the ground a little bit if you look at the Dayanim as being opposing forces in this struggle. However, one of the things that the Rokeach seems to say, and maybe even the Mordechai, is that maybe that's wrong. Because maybe what's happening in a Din Torah with the Dayanim is that it's true, we convene X amount, let's say three, and it's also true that those three do weigh the evidence and the issues, and they really do dispute, you know, what it is that should be done here. But again, that's, to use Reb Chaim's formulation, that's only phase one. You know, what then happens is that, you know, we perceive the result of this deliberation as the consensus that emerges from the integrated, you know, panel of Dayanim. At which point there's no kavua, because there's no, I mean, there is a machlokas on a practical level, but legally there's no machlokas. Legally, there's a mechanism called, to use Reb Chaim's terms, rubo kikulo. So if that's the case, there's no suffek in that sense. There's no roven miut. There's rubo kikulo. There's a total consensus. And therefore, that's what some of the Rishonim explained. There is no din of kavua. Similarly, let's talk about din of nefashos for a moment. We apply the principle of rov not only in mamonis, but in nefashos, as you know. So some of the Rishonim ask, based on a couple of Gemaras in the end of Masechet Yoma. There the Gemara says that, as we know, even a safek pikuach nefesh is something that we violate Shabbos or Yom Kippur, right, to prevent. So if there's a, you know, likelihood this person's going to be fine, but there is some safek, you know, that his life is in jeopardy, right? We transgress Shabbos and we transgress Yom Kippur. So the question is, how come there, you know, where we're not following, you know, the majority or the probability laws, right? We're going that extra mile out of concern for the possibility that, you know, maybe the minority is correct. And yet when it comes to judges and dinei nefashos, right, it's true, you need, in order to convict, you know, a two-man majority. Okay, that's the chiddush, you know, that in order to exonerate the sufficient, you know, with a one-man majority, and in order to convict, you need a two-person majority. Okay, that's fine. But at the end of the day, we're still relying on a majority. So why are we doing that then? But we're not saying on Shabbos, you know, there's an 80% chance the fellow died under the rubble, you know, under the avalanche, and therefore it's a Shabbos, we shouldn't be looking for him. We shouldn't be unearthing it all. Or, I'll just give you one other example, and then you can ask. Even in the discussion, you know, what happens in Yom Kippur, when you have multiple doctors, you know, attending to this patient, or being consulted about the patient. So, you know, we know the rules, most of the rules. One is that if the patient himself is convinced that he really needs medical help, then, you know, he can overrule the doctors, you know, and get the help. On Yom Kippur, he can eat on Yom Kippur. And also, we don't go by the majority of the medical opinion, you know, when it comes to, you know, ignoring, you know, if there's a majority, but, you know, it's counterbalanced by, you know, a significant minority as to whether or not eating is required on Yom Kippur for this patient. So there are different views, but mostly we're worried about pikuach nefesh. So suffek pikuach nefesh is something that we violate. So how come suffek pikuach nefesh we violate in both of these cases? And yet, when it comes to dayanim and dinei nefashos, we go basa rov. Again, a two-man rov. It's okay. So it's going to be, of the 23, it's going to be 13 to 10. Right? So, fine. But that still leaves a very, very big hole in terms of safek pikuach nefesh. So the Meiri in Masechet Yuma has a very, very, maybe the strongest and clearest statement, well, maybe the second strongest and clearest statement of the Rishonim, you know, that anticipates this idea of Reb Chaim. He really says, well, Dayanim is a totally different experience because that isn't based on a majority. That's based on the totality, right, of the consensus and the process that emerges from the debate and from the and from this entire you know, Din Torah. And therefore you can't compare it in a situation where the avalanche falls on the individual and there's an 80% chance that he's no longer alive, you know, but there's still Al-Pidin, legally, we acknowledge that there's a 20% chance that he is. That's safek pikuach nefesh. And when it comes to the argument between doctors, we do take the more conservative view, I mean, the view that is more, that is advocating, you know, intervention on behalf of the patient, because there's a legitimate, legally, a legitimate disagreement between the parties. But when it comes to dayanim and dinei nefashos, even if it's 13 to 10, which is not such a huge majority, nonetheless, what we're really saying is that the 13 define the total conclusion, right, as accepted by the 23. So legally, there's no minority view anymore. Legally, we have Vaday established that this is the rule. There's a question. Yeah.
Don't we just say that in case of pikuach nefesh, we have a pasuk, v'chai b'hem, which we don't have in the...
Well, the chai b'hem doesn't really tell you anything about safek pikuach nefesh. The chai b'hem really is understood in the Gemara's in Sanhedrin, actually, and up Ein Dalet and elsewhere, as demanding that, you know, Jews faced with the opportunity of martyrdom, or the possibility of martyrdom, depending on your point of view, really should choose to embrace life, even at the expense of, you know, religious observance, with some exceptions. The Gibel Averos, Shas Hashmad, Farhasya. But otherwise, the rule is, V'chai bohem v'lo sheyamus bohem, meaning Judaism considers life sacrosanct, practically, and, you know, therefore, there are certain circumstances where life is not worth living, but in most cases, it certainly is, and therefore, that's the priority, even at the expense of otherwise cherished, precious Dinei Torah. That's what B'chai Bohem says. It doesn't say anything about, you know, how to manage, you know, risk. Not really. Well, at least it doesn't have to.
But isn't that an imperative that you cannot treat it as an ordinary Zakai versus Chayav deliberation?
Well, B'chai Bohem has nothing to do with how you treat cases of Dinei Nefashos. That we learn from, you know, the psukim themselves are a little superfluous, and the Gemara derives from them that you need an extra rove, and that's why you have to have a two-man rove rather than a one-man rove if you want to convict. But that's not based on the chayba. That's just based on. Moreover, that doesn't deny that, you know, that we utilize or employ majority or probability in Din Nefashos. It only says that the probability has to be stronger. Now, whether that stronger probability is just kind of a nod, you know, and kind of like an extra, you know, acknowledgement that there's something greater at stake here, or whether it really affects, you know, the quality of the probability, I think is an important question, but not for now. But either way, it's nothing to do with Chaibahem. Chaibahem is a different story entirely. Okay? Good. Anyway, so these are two examples, the Sugya of Kabua and the Sugya of Ein Hokam B'Nefashos, or Safek Pikuach Nefesh, or Ein Hokam B'Nefashos, Acharov, generally. These are two other examples where the status or the way that we look at the way the mechanism of Beis Din is going to impact, and there are numerous other ones as well, as we'll see in a moment, a few others, but some we won't see. Yeah. Well,
what's the difference whether the piece of meat is in his garment or on the street?
Say that again?
What's the case of Kavua?
Kavua is, if I find a piece of meat on the street, and I don't know what its origins are.
That's not Kavua, is it?
No, that's called nimtza.
And so what is the case of kavua?
Kavua is when, you know, the safek is traced back to the mokom kavua. What was taken out from, you know, this...
what would be an example?
These establishments. The same case, just that not I found a piece of meat on the street. There's a piece of meat... I took a piece of meat from this butcher shop and from this butcher shop and from this butcher shop, and you know the question is to figure out which one came from where. For example, that's an easy case.
That's kavua.
That would be kavua, sure, because they all came from. This one came from this store, and this one came from that.
He has 10 pieces of meat in his basket, and he doesn't know.
It could be. It doesn't have to be 10 pieces either. You know, or as long as any case where. Hasafek nolad, you know, bikavua, bikavua. Or you throw a stone into a group of people, let's say, and one is somebody who, you know, is a trefa, and, you know, let's say you're not, or whatever, and it hits somebody, and the question is, you know, is that considered to be legally an act of murder? You know, or not. That's the case the Gemara speaks about in Ksuvos on Daf Tezvav. But they're all standing in one place. So that they, you know, when the object is thrown, and, you know, it's going to end up with one of them, but they're all clustered in one area. Right. That's called Hasafek Nolad Bikvias. Now, what it's really based on, is it that there's no Taroves, or, you know, there are different, it's kind of like an, my personal theory, I just don't want to get into this right now, is that it's connected to the, just as, you know, we have a notion called ikva isura, right? You bring a korban asham talui on, you know, if you have, again, a piece of meat and you don't know whether it's, you know, chelev or shuman, you don't know whether it's kosher or treif, you know, that's a safek. But let's say you have two pieces of meat, you know, in front of you, and you don't know which one is chelev and which one is shuman, right? That's called ikva isura. We know that one of the two pieces on the table is kosher and one is treif, and they're both staring at us, right? So now again, probability wise, there's no difference in any of these cases, right? What difference does it make? Let's say there's 50%. There's one piece of meat on the table, and there's a 50% chance, for whatever reason, there's a 50% chance that it's kosher and a 50% chance that it's treif. So too, you have two pieces on the table. One is kosher, one is treif. And you're going to eat one and not the other. Right? So that's called ikva isura. And for that, you bring a korban asham tali. Let's make it even stronger. Yadua mefursam hu, that the Rambam sheet, although it's a little more complicated than people think, but, you know, in general terms, the Rambam Shita generally is known to be that the rule of Safek Doraisa Lachumra, right, is only Durabana. Again, there are exceptions. One of them is Hashem Tali, but there are some other exceptions too. But let's assume for a moment, forget about the exceptions. That's the general rule of the Rambam. Now, there's most of the Rishonim, the Rajba, the Ran, the Ramban, most of them think that the dichotomy between Safek Doraisa L'chumra, Safek Drabana L'kula is a Doraisa dichotomy. That's if you have a doubt about a biblical prohibition, we're stringent. If you have a doubt about a rabbinic one, we're lenient. That's a Din Doraisa, according to Moshe Shonin. But the Rambam thinks, at least in many cases, that's not true. That across the board, Safek is L'kula, Min HaTorah. It's just Midrabana that we're Machmir when it comes to Yisurei Torah. But everybody agrees that no one can deny, can't deny it, because psukim in Chumash, right? So there are psukim in Chumash that talk about Korban, Asham, Toli. So it means that no matter what you think about the Rambam's view about Safek Doraisa, you know, Midoraisa being Lakula and only being, you know, Lachumar Midrabanan, you can't deny that Asham Talu, you can't deny that in Ikva Yisura, that the Ram thinks that it's Safek Doraisa Lachumar. Right? Mm-hmm. The question is why. So to me, I think that Ikva Yisura is kind of the Avtipus, if you will, the paradigm for Kavua. Okay, but I don't want to get more into that. That's, you get the general idea. Okay. So these are some other, and you know, v'chahena v'chahena. So I just want to discuss, since the question was raised and then we made the allusion to it, but one of the most important Gemaras is the Mishnah and the Gemara on Chaf Tes Amud Aleph and Lamed Amud Aleph. That's what I want to turn to at the moment regarding these, some of these questions. So the Gemara, and so let's start with the Mishnah. On Chaf Tes Amud Aleph, famous Mishnah, what's that? What's that? Yeah, Ketzad Bodkin. So the Mishnah says, Ketzad Bodkin is Sa'edim. We'll just read it quickly. Mostly we're interested in the end. Ketzad Bodkin is Sa'edim. How do you interrogate, witnesses? Right? So the rule is, how you machnisin alson l'cheder. You know, we used to, they would gather them in a particular place, in a room, u'ma'aymin aleihem, they would, warn them a little bit, right? U'motzin es kol ha'adam l'chutz, then they would take everybody else outside, u'mishayim es ha'gadol shebahen, u'omrim lo, right? Emor hecha ta yodeh sheze chayev lazeh, right? How do you know that A owes money to B? Him hu omer, Amarli Shani Chayev, right? Ish Ploni Amarli Shu Chayev, Lo Amar Kol Makat. That's called Eid Mipiyed. Let's say it's called hearsay, right? Ad Shi Yomar Bifaneinu Hoda Shu Chayev Lo. Okay. And again, then after that, first I have to determine that his knowledge is direct knowledge, not indirect knowledge or hearsay, and so on. Achach Maknisin Sasheni. They brought in the second aid, who bodkin also, right? Im nimtzu divrei bechuvanim, if their stories coordinate, nosim and osnin bedavar, then desdin would turn, to their part. That's once they had the facts, just the facts, they would turn to the deliberation, the legal analysis, right? Both of the facts, and of the legal implications of the facts, right? And then, after they finish the discussion, then they would vote. That's called getting to the Gemara Din. Shnayim Omrim Zakai, right? If two people said, the case is Reuven's. He's the one who, should win this case. Echad Omer Chayev, Zakai. Shnayim Omer Chayev, Echad Omer Zakai. Chayev, Echad Omer Chayev, Echad Omer Zakai. Afilu Shnayim Mezakin, or Shnayim Mechayevin, Echad Omer Eini Yodeh. We'll get back to this in a minute. Yosifu Hadayon. So if you have if it's a unanimous decision, obviously there's no problem. If it's a clear majority, 2-1, in either direction, that's not a problem. If you have one, and Einin Yodea, obviously that's a kind of a deadlock. But even if you had two, this is a bigger chiddush, 2-0, I mean two mezakin against zero mechayvim, or vice versa, 2 mechayvim versus 0 mezakin, and the third dayan says Einin Yodea, so the rule is Yosifu Hadayanim. We add judges. Okay, we'll get back to this halakha pretty soon. That's not the first thing I want to discuss right now. But if we have a chance, we'll get back to it today. If not, we'll do it next week. Why is it, we've already alluded to this problem, why is it that we add judges in the case of one, one, and one, we understand, because of deadlock. But why do we add judges when it's two, zero, one? Right, the worst that could have happened would have been that the Eini Yodea would have voted against, and he would have been outvoted 2-1. So why is Eini Yodea worse than a vote against? That's an important halachic puzzle, and possibly an avenue to an important halachic principle, which we're going to get back to. Anyways,
no, excuse me.
Then we're saying, I'm sorry, we'll get back to that.
Did the judges judge separately or in conference with each other?
Well, Masamatan is in conference with each other.
Well, so that means that if somebody says, Eini Yodea, he's refusing to participate in the discussion.
So we'll discuss
where
that.
If he did,
well, I don't think Eini Yodea means...
He might have turned the other opinions.
Okay, good, excellent. So that's going to be one of the...
Right.
I would say that I accept the Seifa, and we're going to discuss that more fully, but not the Reish. In other words, it's very possible that he participates, right, with the discussion. The question is, the simple shot is that he certainly participates in the discussion. In the end of the day, he's not able to come to a conclusion. But it still might be that his inability to come to a conclusion, is a flaw in the,
advocacy.
In the advocacy or how compelling the overriding, that's one of the things that we're going to be discussing, and I think that's what I meant about an avenue to an important principle. So you're 100% right. I'll just say now, we'll probably get back to it, in my opinion, there's such a thing as a hard Eini Yodea and a soft Eini Yodea. Mm-hmm. There's an Eini Yodea which basically doesn't engage, doesn't have an opinion, he's indifferent or just, uninformed, etc. And, that doesn't contribute very much. That doesn't necessarily mean he's not there, but, he certainly doesn't seem to be engaged or at least constructively engaged. There can be a hard Eini Yodea, where somebody... is convinced of both sides. He can see both sides very clearly, and yet can't come. All good conscience can't come to a conclusion. So it's not his, lack of engagement. It's his inability, right, to come to some sort of a decisive determination. That could be a personality thing. It could be about a particular case and a particular issue. I'll call that the hard Eini Yodea. And that kind of person can even make a contribution in the discussion. He might be the best, rhetorician, around. He can argue both sides of this case so well that he can't convince himself, and he probably confuses everybody else. What?
You're the Rosh
Hashiva. 100%. You have to be Yodea L'Tahir Sasheretz. You have to know also when not to be L'Tahir Sasheretz. You have to be Yodea L'Tahir Sasheretz, but you shouldn't do it. Anyways, I'm referring to Gemara, later on, where the Gemara says that, people who are sitting on a bezin have to have that intellectual capacity. And the Bali Tosis asks the question, what is it, Pilpula Shel Hevel? Like, these are mental gymnastics. What is this, an intellectual competition here? So the Bali Tosis doesn't mean that. It means, to be exposed to, different dimensions of the issue that are practical. Others, I think, would tell you that the mental gymnastics, the capacity for mental gymnastics, not Pilpula Shel Hevel, not empty ones, not games, but not gaming the system, but really, exploring it in a way which, can be very creative and really can let's say, challenge, assumptions. What do they call it these days? Thinking out of the box, that's an important skill. Again, you also have to know when not to abuse it. You have to know, how to use it and when to stop using it. So these are all very important issues. Okay, we'll get back to them. Anyways, then comes the end part, which is what we're primarily interested in right now. How do we know that, what happens when they face the press? All those cameras are shooting off, and, the verdict you know, is red. So everybody wants to know who voted how, right? So the Mishnah says, it's very important, I'm a good guy, right? Nebuch, I got outvoted, right? I'm a ma'aseh. Shechaverai ravu alai. Al zeh the Mishnah says, lo telech rachil bi'amecha, v'yomer holech rachil megale so. You're not supposed to reveal. This is very fascinating. So the question is this an issue just of tznius? That's what we were talking about, right? Is it just a matter of privacy? That's already an amazing idea, right? And so foreign to today's blogging culture. Transparency is an important thing. Again, it's like everything else. You need to know when you should be transparent and when, you know, you should be opaque, right? For the sake of tznius. Transparency when it's a function of honest dealing or people, you know, having a proper, necessary proper, awareness of what's going on, and what's not going on in many cases is a very critical thing. But the idea that everything that happens to anybody and everybody, is fair game is relevant to, is appropriate to be known by everybody, which is kind of the culture in which we now live, that is so foreign to the Torah's values. Okay, so basically, one way to look at this is that it's a tznius question, or closely related, a lashon hara question. You know, if this information is private, then it should remain private. The question is there also another element to it? Namely, is this also a legal question? Or to put it differently, because the psukim that are being quoted here are unquestionably psukim that have to do with rechilus, right? They have to do with tznius and they have to do with lashon hara. So it's easy to say this is not about Hilchos Sanhedrin, this is about Hilchos Deos. But what I'm trying to suggest is that that may not be true. Maybe the reason this is a Hilchos Rechilos or Lashon Hara or Deos kind of a problem, the reason that it's preferred that it be private is because legally it's irrelevant and it's not even accurate, to be disclosing who voted how, because that's just not legally precise, because at the end of the day, this is what we're talking about. If the decision was made by two judges and the third one was overridden and he, is not a party to the conclusion, although he was a party to the process, then maybe there would be reason to reveal or disclose it. Or if not, then it would be only or exclusively a rechilus or a privacy issue. However, if we take the view that this is legally a process which is kind of undersigned by all three, and it's all about, the producing this result by the Rubo Kikulo consensus, so on a certain level, right, formally, and again, pragmatically, it's true that living, breathing Ruvain, voted this way, and living, breathing Shimon, voted that way, and living, breathing Levi voted that way. That is, that's beyond any question. But the answer is, legally, is that really what happened legally or formally? No. What happened was three Dayanim, Ruvain, Shimon, and Levi, or maybe we don't even have to bother with their name, Ruvain, Shimon, Levi, right, met, discussed, and produced a unified result. And everything that went on between them, is legally inconsequential. In which case, revealing it is rechilus, but it's a rechilus, it's a Hilchos Deos that comes through Hilchos Sanhedrin, not one that bypasses Hilchos Sanhedrin, if you will, just to use symbolic terms. So this is the question that we are looking at. Okay, so
they disclose the vote but not who, or they just don't disclose the vote at all?
Not so clear in the Mishnah. Not so clear. If it's, obviously the Rechilus part is particularly who voted for who, who's a good guy, who's the white Dayan, and who's, you know, the, you know, the, you know, the, you know, the, you know, the terrible, you know, intransigent Dayan who has no empathy for other.
What?
Right, I'm saying it's not so clear. So in terms of the, what I'm saying is in terms of the Rechilas part of it, you know, not disclosing who would be sufficient. In terms of the Sanhedrin part of it, maybe even the fact that it was, you know, not unanimous is irrelevant. Hard to know. It's a good question. Not so easy to pin down.
Isn't it potentially relevant to a claim of malpractice?
Excellent. So, that's exactly... Either you get credit because you're anticipating the Gemara, or you don't get credit because you should know that.
No,
this
we're not allowed to sue judges. Judges have absolutely.
No, I understand, but we already know from our discussions on Daf Gimel that there isn't a concept of now again only ones that are not licensed by the Reish Galusa or that don't have smicha, that there are issues as we know, and is it artificial or is it, you know, fundamental that you can sue. These are all interesting questions. In other words, they go back to what we discussed this earlier in the year, this question of whether, you know, legal malpractice is, you know, something that, you know, is the norm, or it's a kind of, an artificial exception in order to, you know, promote, I guess, greater responsibility. But I don't want to get into that at the moment. I think it's an important question. What I'd rather get into is the issue itself.
Is there an appeal process?
What do you mean appeal process?
Once the judgment's been rendered, can go to
the not Bezna really. Bezna. I mean, again, you can bring the issue to the Bezna Gadol. Or if they're before the Gemar Din, there's a debate, you know, that cannot be resolved, you know, then in theory, you know, the Dayanim could go to the Bezna Gadol before they pass it. But all things being equal... as we'll see, you know, dino din, as long as there's no toes, and even there's a toes b'shikol adas dino din. That's really the case of legal malpractice is really a case, as the Gemara describes numerous times, you know, both on Vava ben Aleph and especially in the Sugya Neflam and Gimel. It's what we call toes b'shikol adas. But if you have a toes midvar mishnah, which means you make an egregious mistake, you know, which should be accessible to any junior, even less than junior, you know, student of the law, right? That's a toast b'dvar mishnah. Toast b'dvar mishnah is chozer. The psak is just overturned. However, if you make a procedural, methodological, maybe it's probably a little stronger than that, meaning we have, you know, a mesorah and not a paskin. That's something it solves every single case. But there are certain, like, you know, basic rules of thumb that certain things that we follow, right? You know, we know that if there's a machlokas, that there are certain, it's not arbitrary every time there's a machlokas, you know, you just take a dart and you throw it at one of the opinions, or you choose what you like, right? There are ways to break deadlocks, there are ways to handle these things. Question of stature, hierarchy, numbers.
Well, Moshe, the get of cleaves.
Okay,
you
what
know,
about
I
the
mean,
other
a basin paskin, but another basin.
No, that's something else. I mean, that doesn't, you know, you're talking about the time of the Noda Behuda, so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like, you know, the jurisdictions. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, where you have clear, you know, classical jurisdictions, you know, a Bezna Gadol, a whole system, and so on and so forth. Even then, there are rules, you know, about, you know, one Bezin, you know, trying to you know, overturn or override, you know, the psak of another Bezin. But. Yeah. We understand that in much later times in Jewish history, things were much more fragmented, and there wasn't a unified system going on, you know, across countries or even within countries where Jews.
So let's say that second basin, wouldn't it be important to them to know the composition of the vote of the first basin?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. I don't see why. Anyways. So the Gemara here is very fascinating. Look at the Gemara on Lamed Abed Aleph, and you'll see it's exactly what you just said. The Gemara immediately zeroes in on the implications for legal malpractice. So the Gemara says, Shnayim Omrim Zakai. This is five lines down from the wide lines, right? At least in my Gemara. Everybody have that?
Yeah.
Okay, you have two dots. So the Gemara says, Shnayim Amrim Zaka v'chula. So fascinating. The Gemara says, Michtav Heichi Kosvi. How do you write the Psak Din? Because what's the proper legal language to present the findings of the court? Right? So the Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan Amar Zakai. Rabbi Yochanan says, you just say the word Zakai. Or Chai, as the case may be. Meaning the cameras are whizzing and the flashes are popping. The flashes pop? Something. And then, the foreman comes out, or the judge comes out, or the chief justice comes out, and all he does is he says one word, Zakai, or Chayim. Okay. of course. But, yeah. So, Zakai doesn't tell you very much. Doesn't tell you, you're asking before. It doesn't tell you whether, right? You were asking before. It doesn't tell you whether it was unanimous. It doesn't tell you whether it was majority. It certainly doesn't tell you who voted how. Just Zakai. Just go to the end, the bottom line as far as the Nidon is concerned. Wow. Seems very stark, but okay. The Reish Lakish, on the other hand, is for transparency and disclosure. Right, he says, Omar, Ploni, Ploni, Mezakin. Right, Ploni, Mechayev. Okay, so we're naming names. So that means two things. Number one, that seems to be an apt or precise legal description of what's happening. Meaning we do acknowledge, right, the individual conscience or the individual voting, that takes place here. And it is, a 2-1 vote, and the Dayanim are actually... And number two, apparently, it isn't Rechilos. Maybe it's not Rechilos, according to him. Because it's true. Because that's really what's happening. So if really this court, the case is being decided by, a 2-1 decision, and the two judges are the ones who... the only ones who stand behind this psak din, although that's sufficient, then that's not rechilus anymore. That's part of din, right?
But didn't it reject rubo kukulo?
Right.
So it sounds like it is. It sounds like what it's saying is that rubo kukulo isn't the principle that underlies majority rule in a bezdin, right? That sounds exactly like what we're saying. So Rabbi Lazar Omer, this is even more interesting. Midivrayan nizdake ploni. It's not just a simple one word zakai or chayev. It's also not every gruesome, gory, I'm exaggerating a little, detail, who voted, how. But I find this to be the most apt description for the Rubo Kukulo in a way, right? Midivrayan. Right? Nizdake ploni, meaning they all sat, they engaged the issue. From this process emerged, right, a Zakai vote. Great. Well, Laman Damar ploni, so then the Gemara says as follows. Okay. Where am I? Okay, 1 second. Yeah, so the Gemara says, my binayu. Okay, so these are three different versions of what, of how you pronounce the verdict, which we're trying to show, correspond to three different perspectives, and how a bezdin works, right? So then the Gemara says, what's the difference? Is it just the formulation of the verdict, or are there some concrete, tangible, consequences to this debate? So here's where we get to the malpractice. Ikebenayu l'shlume ihu manta behadayu. You have to go through this Gemara a little bit carefully. The Gemara says, maybe the nafkamina will be whether the minority judge, who, let's remember what happened here. He's a minority judge, and it turns out that he was right. Right? Because the others, the majority judges, are being sued for legal malpractice, which means that the determination of the court was that the proper conclusion, the proper psak, was given by the minority judge. So the Gemara says the difference between how you formulate these verdicts will be whether or not l'shlume ihu whether he, meaning the third, the dissenting judge, who turns out is the right judge, right? Does he have to pay manta badayu? Does he have to pay his part of the malpractice fee? Right? Dilaman damar zakai. Mishalim. If when the court just says, interesting, the Gemara, he doesn't follow through with Rabbi Lazar, I think, you know, midivrayim does not get ploni, maybe some of the Rishonim discuss it. But let's just stick with what we have, because I don't want to spend too much time on this. So, but basically the Gemara says is, if zakai is the proper verdict, so what are we really saying? We're eschewing, you know, individual judicial roles here, right? We're just saying zakai. So if that's the case, then even the minority judge, who happened to be on the right side of the law here, he should be paying his liability too. Wasn't he part of the psak? Right? If we're going to spell it out, meaning we're giving individual credit, or in this case, it's going to end up being individual blame, you know, for this miscarriage of justice. So then what we're saying is that how many people pask in this case? Two. The third guy was overridden. Okay, he didn't, you know, again, he collects his check and he gets to be called his judgeship. You know, or her judgeship, as the case, well, in halacha, so it's his judgeship. But as the case may be, but he's part of the union, right? But he's not part of the actual decision-making in this particular case, right? So why should he be paying, you know, liability insurance, right? Oh, so this is a fascinating issue.
Why can't they just reverse the decision?
No, because it's toast. That's what I said before. Tos bedvar mishnah is chozer. Tos b'shikol adas is not such an egregious error. It's not like no one, you know, like there isn't some basis for it. It's just procedurally unacceptable. Right? In other words, let's say I say to you, you know, in America, you know, I'm sorry, if you're an Ashkenazi Jew, you know, so then you should be paskening, like, you know, on this particular issue, whatever the issue is, like the Ramah. And, you know, or, you know, you should be following the psakim of Moshe Feinstein, assuming that, you know, his psak in this case is connected to the tradition of Ashka, and not from Avad Yosef, in an area where it matters, let's say. Right? But that is it wrong? What do you mean it's wrong? Not wrong, but it's procedurally wrong. I mean, there's a certain methodology of psak, is a mesorah of psak, how to, even if something isn't totally, absolutely, 100% wrong, it's still not an acceptable psak, and you can be debarred, you could probably be disbarred, I'm guessing, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, you know, for things that are not demonstrably 1,000% wrong, but they're against procedure, they're against, you know, traditional, you know, judicial norms. Maybe disbarred is probably too sanctioned. You know, if people will review your. Put it this way: you know, if they want you to be the next. I don't mean you. Maybe to be nominated as, you know, a potential Supreme Court justice. So they're going to examine your caseload and your case record, and they're going to say not. You don't have to have made egregious mistakes, you know, to be rejected. They're going to say, this is a very unorthodox way, you know, to rule. Not impossible, not demonstrably wrong, but it's not proper. I don't just mean procedure either, or methodology, because that sounds too parve. It's more than that. You know, there are good reasons, you know, for trends in certain decision-making. When you ignore that out of ignorance or callousness, it's bad judicial policy. So that is subject to that. That's what we mean by kind of what we mean by toz b'shikol adas, meaning there's a machlokas, but we normally paskin when there's this kind of machlokas in this way, and you're paskining that way, and it's not just because you're a maverick; it's because out of ignorance or callousness or whatever, or lack of experience, and it's just not acceptable, even though it's not 1,000% wrong. So you're not chozer. The, you know, we don't overturn the judgment because it's not that level of mistake, right? But no one's going to be nominating you for more than this. Moreover, they're going to be suing you as you know, for bad judicial judgment, a conduct unbefitting, a judge on this level. Do you understand? That's what Tob's speaking. Now, it's fascinating, but I don't want to get into it right now. It's how you apply that, especially as the halakha, we'll use this word and I'll explain it, evolves. In other words, there's a whole literature about what a tos b'shikol hadas or what a tos b'dvar mishnah is and how that changes over time. Because you can't, again, this is, maybe news to some people who don't understand the system, but who blog about it, you just can't, jump into a time machine, and go back 500 years and say, well, it's machlokas hatanaim, so I'm paskening like Rav Tarfon. Or at the time of the, of the Gaonim, this was a debate, so, elevele divra lekim chai. Sometimes you can, and often you can't, because, life continued since those points, and bale halacha, that's what we mean by we talk about, quote-unquote, mesora. Meaning we have a methodology of, not an infallible one, and not necessarily a mathematical one, but a very cumulatively, and historically strongly based one of how to, how halacha proceeds. So obviously a certain kind of psak, which in its time was a fledgling, discussion, and there were different views. So that solidified over, generations and generations and generations when the weight of, accepted authority, decisively, if they did, I'm talking different issues, obviously, decisively, weighed in on a certain side. See, you can no longer turn the clock back. To turn the clock back is dishonest, and it's methodologically, totally unacceptable. So there are some, poskim already, who say, like in the time of the Shulchan Aruch, there were poskim who were saying, if you don't know an accepted psak of the Gaonim, in our day, that's the equivalent of Tos B'dvar Mishnah. That's closer. In the time of the Gaonim, if you didn't know it or you disputed it, that would be maybe Tos B'shikol Hadas or maybe even less. Right? Similarly today, right? If you paskin against, not you're the Rav or a Moshe Feinstein or a Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, if you're a regular, posek, and you're not relying on someone else, and you just paskin against the Shulchan Aruch, in an area where everybody paskins like the Shulchan Aruch, it's very possible that that's already called a tos b'dvar mishnah, not just a tos b'shikol hadas. So the categories of tos b'dvar mishnah and tos b'shikol hadas, as opposed to elu velu divra lekim chayim, which is, more evenly weighted even than tos b'shikol hadas, those categories, in many cases, evolve as, Jewish life evolves and certain things become, accepted. And because something is accepted doesn't mean you can't discuss it anymore. But the weight of, again, of history and of authority, assuming that it isn't just a coincidence and there's good reason to think that this was the trajectory, that changes these categories. That's a fascinating thing. It's a window into, how halacha, continues to grow, in a way that isn't chaotic and isn't, arbitrary, but also is not always predictable and is not always mathematical. And that's what makes it the unbelievable system that it is and why it's been able to weather all of the different challenges that it has. And it's precisely those, both the dynamism and flexibility on the one hand, and yet the sense of continuity, mesora, the reliance on great people and so on. It's both of those things together. If you have only one without the other, it's a disaster. It's both of those things together that, make this as magnificent a system as it is. And those are the two ingredients that have to be you know, preserved and cherished in order to move forward. So that, why did I get into this? Because you asked me about the difference between Tos B'Dvarmish and Tos B'Shikhl HaDas. So I'm trying to make the point that sometimes what used to be a Tos B'Shikhl HaDas becomes a Tos B'Dvarmish, and sometimes what becomes an what used to be an Eilu V'Eilu Divra Elokim Chayim becomes a Tos B'Shikhl HaDas. And that's an important perspective. Yeah.
Does based on release and opinion explain their logic?
So that that's another issue. Other Mishnayos seem to say that there can be the Bali Dinim can ask for an explanation, but the explanation does not, you know, in any way exclude. You know, the privacy of the advocates. You know, it's fine to say this is, you know, this is why we were mezaken. You know, for the following, you know, this was the reasoning of the court. And we want that, actually, because that becomes part of the history, you know, and you know, that becomes precedent, and that becomes challengeable also, but also part of this evolutionary process that we're talking about. But that is not in any way mutually exclusive with, you know, the tznius, let's say, that continues to apply to individual votes. Two different questions.
Is the dissenting opinion wanted to release their dissenting?
I don't know. That part I'm not sure. We say, you know, that the Bali Dinim can ask for the reasoning. I don't know whether that... It's hard to know whether that includes also... You know, the discussion and the dissent. But what we do know is that a dissenting judge, you know, who is overruled and has, we'll discuss this in a minute, has to accept the, in this particular case, the process, but he certainly has every right to continue waging his battle in the Beis Medrash, and he certainly has the right to bring this to the Bezna Gadol, you know, as well. You know, he has the right to argue the courage of his conviction. Now, at a certain point in the process, when it comes to Psak, that's the issue of Zaken Mamre. I mean, and ironically, again, if he's not a Bar Hochi, I mean, if he doesn't have sufficient stature, then he can never be a Zaken Mamre. He can be a troublemaker, and it can be, in one sense, a little more outrageous even that he, you know, that he won't give in or that, you know, but he's not a threat to the system because everybody understands that he's not competing, you know, with, you know, in any significant way. But if he is Roy Lahora, which is what a Zaken Mamre needs to be, so then, you know, Shaloi Kishtei Toros, that constitutes like a real challenge, and that's why we're so severe, you know, in penalizing death penalty against the Zaken Mamre. And I think the point is, I think I've said this in the past, but bears repeating, I guess, that it's not that he's this conscientious objector, but Nebuch, you know, he's threatened to fragment the system, and therefore he's on the one hand, he's admirable, and, you know, he refuses, his conscience doesn't allow him to... to give in. You know, Nebuch is going to suffer the death penalty because of the greater good of Shaloye Kishtei Torah. I don't think that that's the right way to look at Zaken Mamre. I think we really perceive Zaken Mamre at that point, as long as he's making the good argument and making it properly, or continues to want to make it in the Beis Medrash, in theory, and to advocate for it, and to try to overturn, that can be even admirable. It probably is admirable, especially if it's really not an ego thing. But his refusal, you know, to acquiesce to the process is a huge ego statement, you know, which ends up being self-worship and ends up not being about the Ribono Shel Olam or Torah, but about his you know, willfulness or his ambition, and that is particularly galling, you know, for somebody who reaches that level, you know, and who also is presenting, you know, his position, you know, in the name of, you know, Kvod Shemayim and conscientious objection. So that, too, is a very critical point. Okay, anyways, sorry, we're getting on all these tangents. But that's why Sanhedrin is so good. Not because our tangents, but because the the issues are so relevant and so process-oriented. Anyways, so what were we up to? What's that? Oh, yeah, okay, so we've explained the Gemara why. So this is a fascinating thing. But then the Gemara says, very, very understandably, the Gemara says, Ulaman damar zakai mishalem. This seemed too extreme, the Gemara says. He's got to pay 30% of the malpractice liability. He was screaming, he was yelling. Okay, he wasn't screaming and he wasn't yelling. But he was, you know, passionately advocating, you know, for proper halachic, you know, result. What do you want from him? Right? Lema lahu. He should turn to them and say, listen, guys, either the Ditzai Sisun, if you had listened to me, Atun Nami Lo Shlimtun, you wouldn't be paying anything either. None of us would be in court, you know, reassessing our mortgages. Right? So basically, what is the Gemara saying here? Right? Is the Gemara saying, it sounds like what the Gemara is saying, is, you know, Hanami, if you take the view of Zakai, you know, he too is part of the formal psak, and therefore he should too should be assessed the liability of that. However, in the end of the day, what do you want from him? What more should he have done? Right? He's an onus, basically. He did whatever he could. He's not a mini zake mamre. So, you know, what's he going to do? Right? He sat with these people. They are outvoted him. But it's not as if he procedurally, you know, was an error. So what do you want from him? So he's not going to pay that third. That's ridiculous. Ella, but the Gemara, now we don't have a nafkamina, right? So Ella, Ika Binaya, listen to this. Ika Binaya, Lishlume Inu, Manta, Dide. Ah! Did they have to pay each one 50%? Or each one a third? And then the guy's not made whole. Okay? So Lamanda Amar, Zakai, the one who says Zakai, Mishalmi, they will pay each one 50%. Why? Because really what's happening is that, there are no individual dayanim here. At the first phase. Meaning the court paskind. Not two dayanim out of three. The court paskind. And the court made a mistake. Right? But the court doesn't have a bank account. Reuven and Shimon and Levi have bank accounts. So now, you know, the breakdown of the court's, you know, liability, you know, we have three, you know, sources to cover the court, right? You know, we come to Reuven and we collect. We come to Shimon, we collect. We come to Levi, and Levi says, what do you want from me? You know, it's true, I'm part of the court, but I also fought tooth and nail, you know, against this ridiculous psak. And they wouldn't be here if it wasn't for me. So my bank account is not going into this. So what does that mean then? The answer is, the court, you know, needs to pay, and one of the individuals, you know, from whose account this is coming out is exempt. So then the court constitutes the parties, you know, who from whom we can collect, which means each one 50%. What about the other mandamar? Where am I? The mandamar ploni. But lamandomer ploni mizakin ploni mechayvin. This is so interesting. Lo mishalmi. So apparently, this view already, the Gemara seems to have changed its view a little bit, is that if we look at them as individuals, right, so there is no court. So we could have thought if they're individuals, and some of them are trying to make this point, so then the psak is based on two. And then each one should pay 50%. The third guy wasn't part of the psak. That's not the way the Gemara is taking it. The Gemara is saying like this. Either way, all three are part of the psak, but as individuals. But one of them, of course, is totally exempt because he voted the other way. So two out of the three individuals are liable, which means there's a two-third liability. Each one pays a third. Ella ike binayu. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I skipped a line. I keep skipping a line. I don't know why. So the Gemara says, Ulaman damar zakai mishalmi. There's another taina here. Ilav atabhadan. They should pay, each one should pay 50% and and they should be, in other words, shouldering, you know, the extra amount. They should say to him, Ilav at bahadan, if you had not joined us in the case, right? Lo hava salik, dina, midi. Then we wouldn't have been a properly constituted court. By sitting with us, in a way, you tacitly, right, you know, signed on, not that he should pay, but at least, you know, that there is a three. So again, this is a taina? That doesn't seem so much. It's more like saying, you know, it's not a din, you know, in the court only. It's a court made of three. It's two-thirds of the court. It's a rubik kakulo, maybe, right? But not, not a 50-50 one, but a 33-33-33 one, one of whom is exempt. Then the Gemara says, Alei kemenayu mishum lo telech rachil be'amecha. So maybe the nafkamina then will not be in terms of liability, but the nafkamina is lo telech rachil be'amecha, exactly what the Mishnah said. Rabbi Yoch, namar zakai, mishum lo telech rachil, Shlokesh omar ploni ploni mezakin, ploni ploni mechaibin, mishum de mechsi kashikra, Rabbi Lazar isle demar, hilka kosvi, hachi, midivrayim, nizdake, ploni. Okay. So I want to bring a couple of points to your attention quickly. I think we're going to have to stop in a minute. You can just, this whole Shaka Matari, of course, is very, very suggestive of what we're talking about. In other words, what is the model here? Is it two? Is it two out of three? Is it an integrated court, you know, and then divided by personalities, right? Or is it an integrated court, you know, and there are no individuals? Okay. Very interesting issue. So let me bring to attention two things. Number one, this last point, where the other Dayanim said, listen, we're not going to pay 50% each. If he hadn't sat with us, right, then there wouldn't have been a Din Torah. So there are two ways to read that line of the Gemara. One is, it's, you know, in Ochanami, this is the inner mechanism of the court, right? It's we who decided, you know, are the exclusive really ones responsible, or the exclusive ones who are the, you know, machriim in this case. However, you bear some liability, or at least we get some exemption from liability by virtue of the fact that, you know, you chose to join us. Okay, so that at least detracts. You chose to join us. You're not, financially liable, so at least we get the benefit of being a little less liable as a result, right? That's one way to look at the taina and the Gemara. Or is this the Gemara's way of saying, not that there's a taina, but that there's a unit here, and the unit is made up of individuals, and therefore, in the end of the day, it's made up of three individuals. So two can never pay more than a third each. Oh. So there could be the following nafkamina. Let's say the Din Torah was said in the presence not of three judges, but of four or five. Let's take five because of Bezin Nota. Let's say you paneled the five. You didn't have to, but you did. Let's say it was a 3-2 decision, or a 4-1 decision, right? So now it's same. You have to redo the math a little bit. You know, we're not dealing with thirds and halves, so we're dealing with whatever it is that we're dealing with, right? In terms of the proportions, depending on the 4-man bezin, 5-man bezin, etc. But on a technical level, you no longer have the claim of, you know, if you hadn't sat with us, we wouldn't be a bezin. That's not true, because there are three of them who are self-sufficient for Beis Din, and who are, the decisors, you know, in this particular case. So if this is just a taina, it's a way of saying, listen, say what you will, it's true that we're the ones who made the decision, but it's also true, you know, as a factor, that, you know, by sitting with us, you know, that just changes the equation. But that's not true in a case where they were the decisors themselves are self-sufficient and they didn't need the extra individual or individuals involved. However, if that comment or that statement isn't just an extraneous, you know, argument, you know, to justify downgrading their obligation. But let's say it's just a way of highlighting rubo caculo. It's a way of saying, listen, you know, it's true that you voted, you know, what turned out to be the proper, you know, law. And for that reason, it's also true that we can't detract from your bank account, right? But that doesn't alter the fact that we are a unit, a team, right? The consensus of which came from all of us. So while your bank account is protected, right, the fact is that there were still three dayanim here, and if there were three dayanim, then the splitting of liability, you know, has to go on the basis of the actual dayanim, not necessarily the dayanim who are liable. Now, if that's the case, that argument is true, whether we're dealing with a three-man bezdin or five-man bezdin or 17-man bezdin. At the end of the day, whoever sat as a court was a rubo caculo consensus unit, and while those who voted properly in retrospect, again, are exempt, at the end of the day, in terms of diffusing or spreading, you know, or calculating liability, these are all part of the court, and that should dictate. So that's number one. That is actually a comment of the Rush. If you look on Daf Chaf Tes Amud Aleph, I'm sorry, Lamed Amud Aleph, in Sanhedrin, I think it's Simon Hay, the Rush makes this comment. One second. No, not so good. Hey, one second. If I can't find it, I'll leave it for next time, but... One second. anybody finding it? Just 1 second, I'll give it another second. I'm not sure why I'm not finding it.
It's obviously on Kufyat Zion.
What? What do you mean by Kufyat Zion?
Well, you have a different system. Well, Lamed Beis, Lamed Gimel.
Yeah, I'm Kufyat Zion. It's around there. I don't want to take too much more of your time. So I have another couple. I have another minute or so. No. Oh, 1 sec. Here in Siman Lamed Gimel, he paskin Zimto Boy Lishlume Beis Hamazakin Mishalmin Shnei Chalakim Mashlishi Potter Baldin Mafsid Chelko. He paskins. Yeah, 1 second. 2/3. I don't know why I'm not finding this here. Okay, I'm going to leave it. I'll copy it for next time. So that's one issue. The second issue, also that the Rush brings up, is what happens if you have a Dayan Mumche sitting with two other Dayanim. A Dayan Mumche, you know, Lerabim, who could be Dan Yechidi.
Don't worry. You should pay it all.
What?
You should pay it all.
So, in theory... No, but they're sitting all together, three of them. and there's a majority, you know, two against one. Let's say the mumcha is on the wrong side. Right? In theory. Strange case, agreed. So basically you have this, what's the point? Can the mumcha and the other fellow turn to the third guy, the minority guy who turned out to be right in the case, and say to him, or say about him, well, he should count in the calculations, even if we're not rating his bank account, because, you know, if he hadn't sat with us, there wouldn't be a Din Torah. No. Because it'd be a Din Torah anyway, because the Yachid Mumcha could be done on his own. So the Rosh mentions that as well. I'm not sure why I'm not finding these Roshes right now, but they're here somewhere on this page. At least they should be. So that's an interesting case as well. That's another example where if it's just a Taina B'Alma, it's not a good Taina. But in fact, this was a Din Torah that was decided by three judges. So if the point is Rubo Kikulo, and that's really all we're saying, right, then it's irrelevant that you could have proceeded otherwise. That's not how you proceeded. So the Pilpula Charifta, maybe that's how I should find it here, Oz Gimel has a discussion. In this case, how would it work?
Oz Gimel?
I think it should, I wrote down Oz Gimel, and mine it's Oz Gimel. Oz Gimel. I don't know why it's not here. Oz Gimel has the following question. The mumcha, let's say in that case, right? So we wouldn't say this halacha. Assuming we wouldn't say this halacha. The Rosh L'Shitasa. The Rosh says in the case of four or five, we're not going to say this. So they'll pay the four or five will pay the whole thing. Or the you know, the machriyim will pay the whole thing. I was suggesting maybe we could argue. In this case of the mumcha, the Rosh says again, they'll pay the whole thing. But how will they pay the whole thing? Ah. This is where the Pilpula Charifta has a comment. It says, they pay the whole thing, meaning the mumcha pays two-thirds, and the other guy pays a third? Or they each pay 50%? Because in a way, I mean, they both sat down, and they were the ones who paskin together against. So, Lemaisa, each one should pay 50%. Normally, they would only pay 30%, 33%, because the other guy, they'd say, but, you know, he should count even though he doesn't count. Here we don't have that because he could operate on his own. Right? But the other way to look at it is, there's a mumcha, then let's say Reuven's a mumcha, Shimon is a regular, whatever, gamir, and Levi is the dissenting judge. Right? So, with respect to Reuven, right, Reuven can't say to Levi, if you hadn't sat down with us, there wouldn't have been Din Torah, because Reuven would have done the whole thing on his own. Right? But that's not true for Shimon. So maybe, again, is it 50-50, or is the mumcha going to pay two-thirds? And a third? I mean, Shimon will pay a third.
Of 100%?
The mumcha will pay...
Of 100%.
No. Either way, the Rosh is saying, both in the case of four or five judges, and in the case of the mumcha, the Rosh is saying, unlike the case of the Gemara, there should be 100% payment. But the Pilpula Charifta's question is, where does the 100% come from? Well, there are two decisors, so 50-50? Or since the whole point is that the mumcha is the one who could have sat on his own, right? So let him pay the extra third, but why should Shimon pay 50% because of Reuven's ability? So Reuven should pay two-thirds, and Shimon should pay a third. Okay, so I mentioned next week, I'll try to find these lines next week, but let me, one other case I just wanted to mention, and that is, let's say you have the following issue. Let's say you have not a case where there was a dissenting judge and let's say there was a unanimous decision. Three judges all made a mistake. Tos b'shichladas. right? And now, ideally, they should be liable, right? And he said, not a complicated case. He said, you pay a third. Let's say one of them doesn't have any money. He can't afford it.
That's what I asked him. Well, let's say the two judges who are liable don't have a bank account. Let's say they don't have anything.
Right, so what, does one have to pay everything?
So if they're jointly and separately liable as a unit...
So this is something I want to talk about next week also. That's a debate between the Ksos and the Sivas. In Bava Kamma, sorry I'm a little late, but in Bava Kamma we have a principle which, you know, is it's debatable when it should be applied. Ileka lishtalu mimihai, mishtal mimihai. The case there is, let's say you have two factors in a nezek, a shor and a bor. It might be a difference if it's a shor and a bor or two shvarim, let's say. But let's say a shor knocks something into a bor. Okay? So, do we say, Ileika l'shtalu mimihai, l'shtalu mimihai? There are two factors here. Let's say one doesn't have any wherewithal. The bala bor or the bala shor. Or the shor, shal hefker. I don't know, whatever it is. So, usually we say this principle, namely... You're not going to benefit from Nezek. So you're not going to say, if there are two mazikim, you're not going to say that each one pays 100%. It's not kefel, it's not a knas. So you cut the pie. Right? But as you say, the idea is that jointly they're chayiv of 100%, or each one's chayiv of 100%, but then you just cut the pie. That's the concept of Ileika l'shtalu mimihai. Do you apply the same thing in Dayanim? But again, they're all on the same side. Three. Or the two, it doesn't make a difference. Right? So the three are all on the same side. So does that mean that each one is chayiv a third? Or that all three are chayiv 100%? Or that each one is chayiv 100%, but there are three of them?
How could all three be liable?
What?
How could all three be liable 100%?
No, meaning as part of the team. Every member of the team stands behind the whole team. How consensus... is this? How unit is it? Is it only unit and therefore if you have all members of the unit? Or is it a unit that each individual is a sufficient part of the unit? So we'll talk about that a little more next week, and then I want to talk about Enio Dea next week, and then we'll move on to modern smicha.
You can also have the unit liable for everyone if it's really a unit. And the other two judges who are wrong don't have hands to respond.
Right. That's what we're saying. When we talk about a unit, we mean it's a unit when all three are involved. Or we mean the unit is a kind of a corporation that we draw upon the individuals to the best of our ability. No, there can be three possibilities here, legally.